Hello and welcome to the Physician Financial Success Podcast. My name is Josh Schmettel, and this is the podcast dedicated to advising physicians how to avoid financial landmines. Today we'll be talking with Ben Utley from Physician Family Financial Advisors. Ben specializes in helping doctors and their families stop worrying about money, start taking action towards a lifetime of financial security. Ben's a certified financial planner with 20 plus years of experience, featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Medical Economics, Physician Practice, and too many other to name physician-focused publications. Ben, welcome to the show, buddy. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Josh.
Yeah, my pleasure. And, you know, from the little I know about you and from what I've perceived on your website, you seem to be one of the most transparent guys I know. I really enjoyed reading your website and the story about you getting into the industry with your one associate, Emmy. And if you wouldn't mind, I'd love to just hear that story and maybe how you just got started down this path to serving physicians.
Right. In the beginning, about 20 years ago, I was Utley and Associates. And the joke around the family was that the associate was my golden retriever, Emmy, who's since then passed on. And as the firm has grown over the years, I've added staff and I have a whole slew of outsourced people who've helped me out here and there. But yes, in the beginning, the associates was Doc.
I love it. I love that. And so how did you get, you know, from there to here where now 90% of your business is advising doctors? And can you kind of give us an insight on how you got moving down that path?
It's a long story, so I'm going to see if I can give you the Cliff Notes version of it. I guess it was back in 1994, I was cold calling at Waddell & Reed, which is where I started out. Managed to land a BMW dealer at that time. And one day, a divorced physician came in who's a BMW buying client of his and was looking for a financial advisor and just figured, well, you know, if this guy's selling luxury cars, he must be doing pretty well. I think I'll use his guy. And so that's how I got in the physician business. She met me, and at that time I was working in a home office, and she came in and sat down, had some well-prepared interview questions, one of which was, why should I work with you? And I didn't have a ready answer, so I was just honest with her. I said, well, because I've never worked with doctors before. And I think she almost fell out of her chair. but you know, I was just straight up with her. I never worked with doctors before, and I told her, I said, I feel like docs get a bad rap. I said, I think people have preconceived notions about them. I said, I don't go to the doctor. I don't know any doctors. I said, so, you know, I said, if you'll just be honest with me about your life and you'll give me the details and, you know, share with me, I'll do my very best to serve you. And I did. And later on, she married a surgeon, which was an interesting challenge for me. I made both of them happy. They referred people that were in their practice who were married to people in other practices, and it grew kind of like that old commercial, you know, they met two people and they met two people and so on.
Yeah.
When about 50% of my clients were practicing MDs and DOs, I rebranded the firm from Utley & Associates to Physician Family Financial Advisors to make it easier for physicians across the country to find me. Along about then, Medical Economics listed me among their 150 best financial advisors. That's back before you had to pay to be on the list. And the practice continued to grow from there. And so today, 90% of the families that I serve contain at least one practicing MD or DO. I like dentists. I only serve one of them who came attached to a doc, and I don't count them among the ranks of the doctors that I serve. But yeah, so about 90% of them, and then there's a few people who met me before I began to specialize in physicians. But today, it's exclusively physicians in terms of new clients.
I think that story sums up why I call you one of the most transparent guys I know. And I bet she did fall off the chair when you said, because I've never worked with a doctor before. That is just great. I love it. And it's a great story. So let's go on to the success you've had since your first associate, Emmy. And, you know, you were recently featured, collaborated on the New York Times article titled Investment Advice for Doctors, First Do No Harm. And in that article, you allude to the three T's, time, training, and temperament for physicians. And I'd love to just get your insights and thoughts there.
Yeah, when I got the email and the voicemail from Ron Lieber, who penned that article, I thought, oh no, here we go again. It's another one of those beat up on the doctor's articles, because I see those all the time. They're perennial. They always have the, you know, Hippocrates, first do no harm thing, or heal thyself. And I just, you know, I was like, okay, this is going to be different. This is New York Times. I'm going to game up for this. So I got my talking points together, and I thought about, why is it that the physician mistakes are just so so out there? You know, why is it that everybody focuses on that? And I think some of it got to do with you know, the mindset of take down the smart guy or take down the rich guy. You know, it's that kid who was always blowing the curve ahead of you, you know, when you're in your science class and you just wanted to strangle him. And I think that comes out for people that are reading these articles today, even in something as broadly read as the New York Times. And
right.
So I really started thinking about it. And I was like, why is this? So first, I think that physicians have more money to make mistakes with than everyone else does. I mean, even a physician who's just getting started is making twice as much as the average worker, and they may go on to make somewhere between 10 and 15 times as much as the average worker, depending on what specialty they choose. So definitely more money in terms of earnings, and as a result, usually more money in terms of assets. Next thing is that they have more exposure. I mean, if you're a physician, you're in the public eye unless you're a radiologist. So, you know, if you're a pediatrician, if you're a primary care physician, everybody knows you. You can't go out and buy groceries without somebody looking at you and going, hey, that's my doctor over there. And, you know, mm-hmm. you haven't done your hair or you're out in your scrubs. And, you know, so I think it's really those two things combined with the last of what I call the three T's, which are time, training, and temperament. So, you know what your day looks like. You start off at 5 o'clock in the morning. You go in, you do rounds. Maybe you clean up the dictation that you didn't get finished yesterday, do all the email that your office manager sent you, and then you actually start your day. You know, you work patient to patient, get pulled into rooms. You know, at the end of it, you go do some rounds. And, you know, if you're lucky, you might get to have dinner. You wind up home around 7 or 8 o'clock at night. And then, you know, you get your kids. They want you to help them with their homework. You've missed some piano practice. I think people don't realize the sacrifices that physicians make for the public good. And a lot of that sacrifice comes in terms of their ability to spend time with their family and also their ability to spend time on their personal finances. So I think docs are just lacking the first T, which is time. The second thing that I think that they're lacking is training. I mean, when you think about a physician and the amount of work that goes into creating a physician, you know, we have to apply the 10,000-hour rule, which, you know, says if you do something for 10,000 hours, you're going to be a master of it. Well, physicians go beyond that. I mean, if you just look at maybe 6 years' worth of training, that's 2,000 hours in a 9-to-5 day, and we know that docs don't work 9-to-5 in their first, you know, 5-6 years. They're working all the time.
Right.
So they probably have somewhere between, you know, 12 and maybe 18,000 hours of training by the time they're sitting there in front of you to render advice or, you know, to do surgery or whatever it happens to be. And we want them to have that. But I also think that, you know, they're lacking training in personal finance, which is practically unavailable. I mean, it's just now being taught in colleges. They're just now financial planning degree programs. And when I started 20 years ago, that just wasn't in existence.
Yeah.
So I think that they just lack the training to be able to make excellent financial decisions and see the big picture and also be able to focus on the minutia. And then the third piece, the third T, is what I call temperament. And, you know, it really just comes down to exercise. You know, when I exercise, I watch a video and I go for a walk because of those are the things that I love to do. And so as a result, I will continue to do those things. I think that the physicians that are successful in managing their own personal finances really like to do it. And the ones that just don't like to do it, don't do it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, it's got to be a priority. It's got to be something you love to do. You got to have the time and the training to do it for it to get done. And as a result, if they just don't have the temperament for it, then it just doesn't get done. And the things that don't get done usually come back to bite you, just the same way it would be if you had an unattended health issue.
I think you're spot on, and I took a couple of notes here. And first of all, let me start back at the beginning here. You said you gamed up for the New York Times editorial, and I just want everyone to know you also gamed up for my little podcast. And you were texting, you were emailing me beforehand, and you know I don't have it in front of me, but something like I want this to be the best podcast of all time. Let's make sure. You're out for bears. You want to be perfect in this. So I think that's just a little bit about your personality. My hunch is you game up for everything, and
yeah.
So I think that's cool. I just want to give you those little kudos.
Thanks.
You're welcome. And so there was another thing you said that really kind of struck me because I have noticed that similar type of beat up on doctors. articles and a little bit of kind of that ridicule. And I wonder if there's a parallel here between healthcare somewhat being, I'm not saying that healthcare has been nationalized, but we seem to be moving in a more controlled medical environment. And maybe a parallel to the media, maybe a national media giving a heavy scrutiny towards physicians. So then, when we take away their rights or we mandate what they can earn, then maybe we've kind of braced the nation for the fact that they're not perfect and they deserve to make less. Am I really stretching it there, or do you think there's any parallel?
Well, I think the public is constantly guilty of short-term thinking in a long-term world. I mean, when you look at the viability of a nation, it really comes down to the strength and the health of its people. It comes down to their education, and it comes down to a fundamental belief system and value system that they all share and live or die by. And I think it's very easy to underestimate the value of a physician in a community when everybody's healthy. It's like, oh, you've done your job as a doc and everybody's healthy, so gosh, really, who needs docs? Let's cut their pay. Let's make life harder for them. But when you're sick, when my kid's sick in the middle of the night, she's barfing, I've got no clue as to what to do because I'm not a physician. I've got a science degree, I've got two chemistry degrees. My wife's looking at me like, what do we do? I'm like, call the doctor,
Right.
But in that moment, when my kid's sick, she's got 102 degree temperature. My God, I want a doctor on the phone, and I want him on the phone in 5 minutes. And I want the doctor. I don't want a nurse practitioner. I don't want an RN. I don't want an urgent care person. I want that person who's got the solution to solve my kid's problem because I love that child more than anything else in life. And I think it's at that moment that we either should or do appreciate our physicians. And it's in that moment we would pay anything to be able to have the problem solved. And I think that if we can instill that kind of reality in the minds of the people who make the laws in our country, then we will have a better healthcare system, we'll have a better life for doctors, and we'll also be healthier.
Well, great job for articulating your beliefs and in that article, particularly making sure that it didn't come across as a beat up on your doctor. I thought you did a great job. So let's talk about your website and some articles that I read there. And specifically, there was some advice for young physicians. And much of my business is young physicians, and I think that's the time to strike. With financial literacy, whether they do it themselves or whether they, get good advice. But like you said, if you don't have a disposition for it, it may just not get done, and you don't want to be looking back in the mirror 15 years down the road. So share with us an overview of the advice you offer young physician clients. I'd love to just talk about that for a few minutes.
Right. Well, with young physician clients, we want to cover the bases. First thing is an assessment with some basic questions like how many banks do you have and do you like your bank? Because, that's where all the money is going to start out its life. Once it's your paycheck, then it's in your bank, and it gets dispatched from there to, all three of the S's, spending, sharing, and saving. So we'll look at something as fundamental as banking. Then we move on, build an emergency fund. So I have an emergency fund plan that tells you exactly how much money you need to be setting aside in your emergency funds. You don't wind up with $150,000 in your checking account or something crazy like that. Then we move on. We look at other bases like disability insurance and life insurance. I've got some great contacts that sell those products. My firm is a fee-only firm, so we just give advice in those areas. We don't actually sell the products. But we do figure out what you have and what you don't have and what kind you need and what amounts that you need. Those are the bases. And then we look at something like retirement and college. And the real thing in a retirement fund plan or a college fund plan is the what and the where. Like, what do I need to save and where do I need to put it? Those are the two essential questions. And if you can get that out of a plan, then you really got the start of it. And then, of course, once you have a plan, overcoming financial inertia is a huge thing. And just getting those things rolling. So opening an account, putting money into it, automating so it happens all the time, and being comfortable with that happening is huge. And then once all those accounts are open and all the money saved into them, then you can tackle the investment question, which is kind of like everybody just wants to dive into the sauce. Everybody just wants, oh, manage my investment. Let's talk about stocks. Well, it's like the seventh thing on the agenda, And of all the things that you can do, it's the least controlled thing of all. I mean, you can't control what the market does. You're predicting what a million idiots will do out there with your dollar bill. You expect to, live on 30 years from now. So it's really the thing that the media is selling, the thing that you see in Money Magazine and the newspapers, is the last thing that you do. And everybody wants to start there, and it's no wonder it's so confusing, because there's a stepwise progress to this, and skipping steps causes you to be exposed. So I think it's important to just kind of work through it one piece at a time. And there's nothing magic about what a good financial advisor does. There's nothing that is exotic about the advice that I give. The fact is that it's just decent advice, but the implementation of it, actually getting it done, is what really matters. I mean, just the ordinary things done in an extraordinary way is really the formula for success. And once you're on track, then avoiding the mistakes keep you on track and make sure you wind up at financial security.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a little bit about mistakes. I know you've got some good advice there, but from what I'm hearing you say, it sounds like step one is you've got to be intentional about this. You've got to start with a good foundation, and I agree with you with everything that young physicians have to worry about between education and boards and licensing and relocating and families and children and spouses. I mean, it's a lot to pack on a financial plan and a foundation around building a safety foundation around you with savings and insurance, and that's why I think it gets neglected. There's just more things to juggle as a young physician than if you're in about just about any other profession in the world, and that's why I think the advice from someone with experience like you is so crucial at that point.
Right. Thank you.
So you also have some specific advice for young physicians starting a family. So I love that about you, and it comes out. I mean, it comes out loud and clear in your website that you've been doing this for more than 6 minutes. you've seen the mistakes. You've seen what's successful. You kind of have that recipe figured out. And so, just share a little advice for us about physicians starting a family.
Well, I'm speaking from the voice of experience here, but not a ton of experience. I have two daughters that are 10 and 12. And since my children are old enough to conceive of resources and to talk about money, I told them a couple things about it. And these are the same things that I would advise, to the extent that I'm licensed to give childbearing advice. I would advise other families to do. First thing I tell my kids is that I'm never going to give them money. And I've held to that for 12 years with my older daughter and 10 years with my younger daughter. Second thing I tell them is it's my job as their parent to take care of all their needs, some of their wants, and a few of their wishes. And right?
I love it.
And to teach them to be able to take care of their own needs when they're adults, to give them all the tools that they need. That's my job as a daddy, and that's her job as a mommy, to make sure that that happens for them. Then I go on to teach them about the three S's, which is spending, sharing, and saving. And it just kind of rolls forward from there. So at this point, my 12-year-old knows how to calculate compound interest, and she's familiar with how a mortgage functions, and she knows the proper use of debt and savings, and they kind of save automatically. But I think that you have to set up the rules in your own household. You have to figure out what your values are around money. And then really adhere to that, or if you're not at home a lot and you have a spouse who's there, or if you have a caretaker, to make sure that they get your values and they understand what your expectations are for your children to start out early. There's a great book called Love and Logic. Uh-huh. You can find it on Amazon. And it really talks to about making choices. And your child comes equipped with the ability to make choices, and you come into that world at the moment when you can hold a red ball in one hand, a blue ball in the other hand, and your child can gesture at the red ball or the blue ball saying, I want that one, even if they don't have the words. It's at that moment that your child begins to make decisions, and it's at that moment that you can begin to craft good decision-making habits in your child. And I think that the good decision-making habits are the fundamental building block for good personal finances, because it all comes down to, what do I do with this dollar?
My wife has Love and Logic, and I know she's read it a couple times, and I haven't read it. So thank you for giving me the motivation to pick that
time
up.
Time to and, get on it.
Yeah, I think I need to take a little responsibility there. Thank you for kicking me square in the pants. And at the conclusion of the interview, I'm going to need your home address, and I'll be sending Xander and Aria your way for the summer, and I appreciate you.
I have four copies of Love and Logic sitting right here on the desk. I'll just tell you
one. Oh, man, I love it. All right. That is such sage advice, man. I love it. I love the I'm going to take care of all of your needs and some of your wants. That is just beautiful. And the transition, right, showing them, you know, at the end of this, at the end of this deal, you've got to get yourself to the place where you can provide for all your own needs. That is just cool to give someone so young the vision of where they need to be, and how that departure from the nest is going to look one day. And I love it. I think it's great.
Right.
So now we have this young physician who started a foundation and some savings and some insurance, and the final step there maybe is started to do some investing. We've given him some advice on maybe philosophy towards children, given a great reference on a book. So now this young physician is moving on to the next stage of their career, and let's say that they're going to make partner, or they've finally got the attending position they've been working so hard for. And you mentioned in your website you've got some advice around that transitional place of an advancement in a career. You want to share some of that advice with us?
Yeah, no, this is the hard part. I'm a longtime tropical fish lover. I did that when I was a kid. I'm still into, you know, life sciences and fish, especially fish. And there's this thing about fish that most people don't know. The average fish, if you feed it, it will grow to the size of its environment.
Wow.
And so when you start off with your personal finances being an intern, you're making very little, but you can live on that. And then, you know, you make resident, you make fellow, and you make a little bit more, and then you practice, and then you get a pretty substantial jump there, and the size of your goldfish bowl grows. And the question is, does your goldfish grow with it? And of course, your goldfish is going to grow a little bit. Your goldfish bowl is the size of your income. Your goldfish is the size of your consumption habits. It's how much money you spend. And the trick is to keep the goldfish from outgrowing the dang bowl. And so when you make partner, usually that's the jump to light speed for most physicians. If they're going to make, you know, higher six-figure incomes, it's going to be when they make partner, maybe after they've outpaced their buy-in debt. But the trick is really just to keep the goldfish in the bowl. And if you can adopt a resident mindset about your personal finances and hold that mindset, as opposed to having kind of a Monty Hall mindset about your new earnings, then you're more likely to make it, because it simply just preserves your margin. So your margin is your the money that you get on a pre-tax basis, less taxes, plus all the cost of living. And that margin, what's left over, is what I call money for financial security. It's the money that you get to save for college, to send your kids to school. It's the money you get to put away for retirement, so someday when you want to hang it up, you'll be ready. It's the money that you can use to buy disability insurance, and it's the money you can use to buy some term life insurance. So money for financial security is what I call it. And the major competing factor with money for financial security is a home. So I think it's important that people think very consciously about the size of their home, and I'm sure that you give them some excellent advice about how much to put in it and when to buy it and those kind of things. So it really just drills down to that level, but keeping that the resident mindset is important in terms of being able to actually achieve financial security, because it's not focusing on a budget. You know, it's not talking about how much you spent on a latte or, you know, how many times you got to dinner. That really doesn't matter at all. The only thing that matters is whether or not you saved, how much you saved, and how early you saved.
Mm. So I hate the B word, budget, but I love the philosophy from The Richest Man in Babylon, which I think is kind of what you're mentioning or alluding to here, which is, you know, as long as you pay yourself first. As long as, and in my house, you know, the way we do that is whenever there's a deposit into the checking account, it's always followed by a debit out to the savings account or to the, you know, to the investment account. And then that's the amount of money left to be spent.
Perfect.
And so that just works for me. I hate, like you're saying, you know, where are we at with vacation spending, or where are we at with latte spending? I really like the, you know, we try and make that a 30% deal. And if we can do more, we do, but that's the debit that goes out every deposit. And I think that's a great way to think through it. So is that kind of the advice that you give clients is just make sure that there's whatever your margin is, that's happening. You pay yourself first before you pay the rest of the world.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with you. I hate the B word as well. I mean, budget is just something that's unhappy about it. So when I do this work with clients, I call it a spending plan. And before you have a spending plan, you need to have a banking plan. And that's not really something that is a product or a service, but it's something we talk about. I encourage physicians to set up two checking accounts. One is what I call the inbox. Another one's what I call the outbox. So the inbox receives all of your inflows. It receives your ACH deposit of your paycheck. And the major outflow from that is your cost of living. So once a month, you move your cost of living out of the inbox checking account and into the outbox checking account. And from there, you spend it down to zero. And you repeat that every month. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, your inbox balance is growing. So what we want to do is tie that to automatic savings plans that put money into 529 plans and IRAs and, you know, if you're self-employed, maybe a SEP, those kind of things, such that, you know, it's not going to change the cash flows. It's going to change the awareness of the cash flows. And I think even somebody who doesn't have the temperament to really do a lot of personal finance, just becoming aware of the cash flows is crucial. One of those cash flows from the inbox should go into a vacation fund. Now, I talked about cutting back the lattes. I think we could probably all use a little bit less caffeine. But the thing that physicians should not skimp on, the thing that they should never skip, it's a vacation for a couple of reasons, not the least of which is compassion fatigue. I mean, show me a physician who hasn't had a vacation in 3 years, and I'll show you a guy who's absolutely miserable.
Yeah.
I think that the compassion fatigue builds up and wells up in physicians, and I think it probably sneaks up on younger doctors more likely than it is on older doctors because, you know, the old docs see this coming. They know that they have limited battery power. Young surgeon, you know, he's taking all the call he can get. He's working on as many people as he can. Doesn't see his family. And what you do is you wake up one day and you're like, oh my God, my kids grew up. You know, I didn't spend any time with them. And your family vacation is a chance for you to reconnect with them and kind of get back on the ground level with them and let them see the human being that's underneath all the medicine and all the running around and getting things done. So, you know, I would encourage people, you don't have to have a palatial vacation. In fact, the shorter vacations are more effective in terms of recharging batteries. But you do need to have a vacation fund. It does need to have money in it. It does need to be set aside separately. And that way you and your spouse and your kids can talk about where you're going to go together, which is a part of the enjoyment of getting time away.
I love it. So that's actually similarly to what we do. We have a, you know, like a money market account that we do the debit on that goes directly in there. And that's the savings. And when that builds up to where, you know, we want to do something with it, then we, you know, advise it whatever, according to whatever the plan is at the time. So you actually have a, just so I understand, you actually have a separate checking account. So money flows into an inbox. You've got a predetermined amount of that money, which you're going to leave in the inbox, whether that's a percentage or dollar amount or whatever that is.
And dollar amount, yeah.
Dollar amount. And then you're going to move the rest of your living costs into the outbox. And that's kind of what you're looking at. Like if I go to the ATM, I'm going to pull money out of my outbox, correct?
Exactly. When you write your mortgage bill, you're going to pay it out of the outbox and you're going to pay all of your bills out of the outbox. It also functions as security because when you send a check out into the world, you're giving your account and your routing number to the universe. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, that outbox is kind of like your public checking account. It's the one that everything's tied to, such that, you know, somebody grabs your identity, that's the one that's really going to be out in the public place. The inbox, the other checking account, is the one that is, you know, nobody's going to see that except for your other financial institutions when you link them by ACH. So it's not as exposed, and you don't want to connect those two together. You just want to be able to move money from one into the other on a monthly basis. And this one thing alone has saved bacon for a few of my clients. I mean, when you work with 40 or 50 families, you see identity theft on a pretty regular basis. And I think knowing that only one of those accounts, the smaller of the two, is exposed is really helpful. The reason it's two checking accounts is there are some federal rules that they limit the amount of money that you can move or the number of transactions you can have in and out of an account. And when that's a true savings account, the limit is 5. When it's a checking account, you can move money in and out as often as you like.
Great advice. I'm glad we untapped that. That's fantastic. Okay. You alluded to avoiding mistakes. And I think that's probably a big part of what you do as an advisor. Share some thoughts with us around specifically physicians and the importance of avoiding mistakes.
Well, physicians, it's no mystery that they're making six figures most of the time, and that's a good start. If they're able to make a plan for those six figures, so they know where everything's going to go and how much it's going to be and how much they need to save, that will allow them to know what to do. Then they get on track. So they implement the plan and they follow it and they keep it up to date. You know, being financially secure and becoming financially secure is not rocket surgery. You know, you don't have to have an advanced degree in it. You don't even have to be a nationally recognized expert to do it, but you do have to do it. And once you do it, you have to leave it alone. You have to not mess it up. And it's the mistakes that physicians make that cause them to be standing in the OR when they're old and gray, thinking about them, sitting on the beach. No, it's those mistakes that cause them to have to work longer than they want to, or have to work in an occupation that they no longer care to. And for the young docs that are listening to this, this is going to come as a totally foreign concept. You know, because usually I'll sit down and I'll say, "Well, what are you thinking about for retirement?" And they're always like, "Oh, you know, maybe 65 or 70 would be good." But when I sit down with those physicians that I've served for 20 years that are now in their early 50s, I say, "When do you want to retire?" And they're like, "Yesterday would be great."
Right.
Because there's always going to be a change, you know, whether it's managed care or it's EMRs, whatever it happens to be, there's always going to be a change and it won't be the same. And so I encourage them to pretend like they want to actually retire when they're in their mid-50s, which will blow a lot of people's doors. You know, docs are coming out with $250,000 in student loan debt. I'm here to tell you that it can be done and you'll work real hard to do it. And once you put all that work in, you sure as heck don't want to blow it. So avoiding the mistakes that physicians make is a big piece of it. Some of the mistakes are little, some of them are huge. I typically see six-figure mistakes in about 20% of the population that I serve. And, you know, that can set you back a whole year at least, because that's six figures on an after-tax basis.
That's right.
And, I mean, you go to work, you make your money, you give about half of it to the government. You know, if you're in my house, you get more than half of what's left over to your family, your kids. You get some to your retirement account. You cross your fingers with the rest of it. By the time it hits my pocket, it's about $100 a week. So, but you do have to avoid mistakes in order to be able to stay on track and actually reach your destination. And the destination is building financial security that can actually last a lifetime, which is to say, you invest in your kids and their college education, and that education will take them through the rest of their life. You save for retirement, and that's money that you're going to spend until you literally hit the grave. So you want to make it last by avoiding mistakes.
I think there could be no better advice for physicians, because as you said, you know, the six-figure income's a given. It doesn't have to be rocket science. You need a basic plan, and you need to follow it. And I'm reminded of a client of mine who didn't have a plan and was very high six-figure wage earner, and quite frankly didn't have an advisor that was advising him like you to avoid mistakes, and ended up building a $2.8 million home in Las Vegas in 2006. Let me give you one guess as to what happened on that transaction. Not good.
Josh, I can't even guess, Josh. What would that be?
Well, he got halfway through it and the builder went bankrupt. And then he had to find that the project was $1 million over budget by the time it was done. And as that 24-month construction program was wrapping up, the entire Las Vegas market melted down, ended up short selling the home, devastating his credit, and he took $1 million loss, cash loss.
Right. And before we take a bat to that guy's head about this $2.8 million debacle, you have to step back and you have to ask yourself, why?
Right.
Why was that mistake even available to this guy? Why did he want a $2.8 million home? You know, why does anybody want to live in Las Vegas to begin with? You know what I'm saying? But sorry. I'm in Oregon. It's beautiful up here. I moved from Texas and all I can say is I like Oregon and I've been to Vegas. So, but you know, you get back to it and you're like, why does somebody need a $3 million home to be happy? I mean, happiness is having joy in what you do. Happiness is spending time with the people that you love. You know, happiness is knowing that you're secure and that things are going to be okay. And happiness is doing your best and making a difference in the lives of others. And none of that calls for a $2.8 million house unless you just got like 1,000 friends and they all like Vegas.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think having your values in line and you know, kind of how you kind of point your compass to north is really crucial. And that's not something that's really financial advice. But I think that when you work with someone who's grounded and centered and really knows what they're about, that you have someone who can mirror those things back to you and say, is this really something you want to do?
That's exactly right. And where I was going with that whole story was, you know, not in the least to take a bat to his head, but to really point out that with a lack of a plan and with an overwhelm of work and responsibilities to your practice, mistakes can be made. And it's important to have someone to bounce that off, whether it's a financial advisor or a father figure or whomever. But
yeah, somebody, best friend, you know,
somebody.
Stranger, bounce that off a stranger. They'll tell you you're not sane.
Yeah, the taxi cab driver may have said, you know, that wasn't the way to
yeah.
go. All right. I always know we've done a good interview when we're past our time and we still have more questions. So I'm going to wrap with this.
Awesome.
But I can't let you go without quickly having you share with me the beliefs that you have posted on your website. Because I you know, I'm young guy, two young children, a 4 and a 2 year old, and each one of these beliefs just hit me right between the eyes. So would you share with me the three beliefs on your website and just real quick overview of what those are?
Yeah, I would. First belief is I believe that every child has potential for greatness. You know, to be able to learn, to grow, to reach their full potential. In order to be able to do that, their needs have to be met, some of their wants, and they have to feel like they're safe and secure. And I think that having a financially stable home helps with that, stable home anyway. So that's the first thing. It's part of why I serve families. Second thing is I believe life is precious, and that your time is only really real asset that you have. I mean, when you leave the planet, you can't take your money with you. We all have a limited amount of time, even though we don't know how much it is. And so it's not really about saving time. It's about using your time wisely. It's about sharing it intentionally. And it's about using it to do things good in the lives of others. And then the last thing I believe is that money is a store of life energy. You know, you're going to trade your time as a physician for money. And that's going to be time that you're away from your family. So if you treat that money poorly, and that means it's almost like you've wasted time that you could have been with your family. If you treat it well, it's like you've honored your family through the use of those resources. So basically, I believe in those three things. And all of those call for values, for process, for understanding, and you know, for really knowing what you want to do with your money, which is a call for planning. And that's why I do what I do. It's why I persist in the business. It is a pretty tough industry. And it's just part of what causes me to love what I do. I feel like it's a privilege when I wake up in the morning, and it's an honor to serve the people who I do serve.
Ben, you've been gracious with your time. I appreciate you sharing your wisdom, and I love what you're doing. So if our listeners want to find out more and read your articles, how do they connect with you?
A couple ways. One is if you Google Ben Utley, Benutley, and the word physician, you'll find me pretty much in the top 10 hits in any search engine you go to. If you want to go straight to the heart of things, you can hit me at www.physicianfamily.com, PHYSICIAN, then the word family, then .com. Otherwise, somebody could give me a ring at 541-463-0899. I answer my own phone. I carry my cell with me. So like I said, you know, when I call my doctor, I want the doctor. When you call your financial advisor, you want to get me. So no receptionist, just straight to the heart of things. Don't be surprised if I pick up the phone on a Friday afternoon, because that's our role.
That's the Texan in you coming out.
That's right.
Ben, thanks again, buddy. It was a pleasure. I look forward to connecting with you soon. Truly, thank you for
awesome.
Your time.
Yeah, thank you so much, Josh. It's a pleasure.